Back at it, you and I today on a midweek Wednesday, May 18th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. I took a few minutes at the start of the program to point out what I see as the Washington-based hypocrisy surrounding the current white replacement theory narrative. Yeah, it's been around a while, but not from the party that you might think. Heritage Foundation analyst Darren Backs talked about what's causing the current U.S. baby formula shortage. And former Time magazine reporter Alan Sanders, back on the program, recapped some of Tuesday's big primaries across the nation. I am not surprised, as we begin today on a midweek Wednesday, not surprised that again, at least one member and likely two of our Senate delegation is doing what I like to say is going for the index card campaign, the, well, the Republicans should be terrified and they should apologize to the American people and they should condemn this and condemn that, of course. Senator Chris Murphy, our junior U.S. senator, saying that Republicans should condemn the hateful theories about replacement. And what did I tell you folks 3 or 4 days ago? As soon as they got the skinny on this crackpot, this nut, who we find out today, by the way, was also torturing animals. He apparently had decapitated a cat. This nut, this whack job, then should have been tied up and left in a rubber room for a few months, and went and killed 10 innocent people in Buffalo. He also decapitated a cat. All right. Any criminal mental health expert will tell you that there are two things that almost always indicate a criminal psychosis. One is pyromania, a fascination with or setting fire to something. The other is animal abuse, right? And now we find out that he decapitated a cat and his parents gave him a box to bury the cat in. Folks, I'm telling you, just like Parkland, just like so many other of these mass killings, plenty of people knew there was something off with this nut, this crazed individual, and whether it was the parents, whether it was the mental health people, whether it was his relatives or his school folks, they just chose not to do anything. But again, all we can count on from one side of the aisle is white replacement theory. Oh, white replacement theory. Chris Murphy calling on Republicans to condemn hateful theories about replacement. During an interview on MSNBC's Morning Joe on Thursday, Murphy argued that a majority of extremist shootings that take place in the U.S. are done by white supremacists. You see this through El Paso to Charleston to Buffalo, in which white supremacists who feed off this online conversation, Chris Murphy said, about replacement theory, fed by mainstream conservative and Republican institutions, are turning their anger into mass violence. Well, okay, that's what Chris Murphy says. So I did a little searching last night here when I was home devouring dinner, what passes for dinner in my house anyway, and I came across this. And thankfully, a conservative columnist by the name of Rich Lowry, L-O-W-R-Y, who is hardly a MAGA guy. This guy is, he's still around. He was around during the Trump years. And Rich Lowry was around during the Bush years. And I think he may tail back to the Bush 41 years. I don't know. But he's one of these what you would call mainstream conservative columnists. The guy is certainly not a what you would call a MAGA guy or a Trump devotee or anything. But I tell you, he hit a home run with this column. Column dated yesterday, the 17th, on Tuesday. Democrats advocate high immigration to gain political power and then smear Republicans when they call them on it. And he is spot on this. So Dick Blumenthal, Chris Murphy, Rosa DeLauro, Joe Courtney, Jim Himes, Johanna Hayes, John Larson, all of you. You want immigration to help change the makeup of the electorate when it suits you. But man, oh man, damn, did Rich Lowry lay it on the line here. They smear Republicans who talk about it. They smear Republicans who talk about it. Rich Lowry mentions this in his column. Back in 2013, the left-leaning Center for American Progress. Now, by the way, the Center for American Progress, they did a lot with the Obama campaign, too. Okay, so listen to this. Listen to this. Now, I hope Chris Murphy can find this. I hope his staff knows how to use the Google because it was easy for me to find. And it's in the New York Post. You know, the New York Post that had that story about Hunter Biden's laptop and emails that they said was Russian disinformation. Yeah, that New York Post. The Center for American Progress back in 2013, 9 years ago. The Center for American Progress, 9 years ago, issued a report. You know what the title of the report is? Immigration is changing the political landscape in key states. Eh? Now, before you say, well, they're talking about legal immigration. No, they're not. No, they're not. That report, that piece from 2013, and make no mistake, the Center for American Progress is a very influential left-leaning think tank, as much as the Heritage Foundation is on the right, I would argue. The summary of their report back in 2013 said, now get this, supporting real immigration reform that contains a pathway to citizenship for our nation's 11 million undocumented immigrants is the only way to maintain electoral strength in the future. I'll read that again. So a left-leaning think tank that's got a lot of juice in Washington, don't think these people are crazy. There are a lot of Democratic devotees to the Center for American Progress. If you don't believe me, look it up. Don't believe a word I say, look it up. They issued a report in 2019, immigration is changing the political landscape in key states. Their summary, supporting real immigration reform that contains a pathway to citizenship for our nation's 11 million undocumented migrants is the only way to maintain electoral strength in the future. Is that not a replacement theory? Huh? Basically, the Center for American Progress, since back in 2013, you know what they're saying? Legalize illegals so we can win elections. That is exactly what they are saying. Again, a 2002 book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, called Democrats the Party of Transition, as white America is supplanted by multiracial, multiethnic America. In 2016, Steve Phillips published Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution has Created a New American Majority. His publisher's website says the book contains, quote, hope for a more progressive political future lies not with increased advertising to middle-of-the-road white voters, but with cultivating America's growing diverse majority. Oh, so I guess you want to replace whites. Right? So, Senator Murphy, if you're listening, Senator Blumenthal, if you're listening, Congresspersons DeLauro, Himes, Larson, Hayes, Courtney, sirs and madams, if you're listening, well, maybe there is a white replacement theory out there. Sounds like it's coming from your side of the aisle, right? Sounds like it. Oh, we have to make the 11 million illegals legal in order to shift the politics in this country. Well, you tell me, what's that? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Folks, I'm telling you, folks like Chris Murphy have really short memories. They have really short memories when it's their own damn party writing books about it, pushing immigration policy that say, hey, we need this to maintain our majority. But then if there's any allusion to it, wow, look at those racists over there. Really? what side, as always, plays the race card front and center? The race card. They still play the race card more than the gender identity card. It's getting close. But the race card is still number one with Democrats. Don't believe me. Look up these books. Look up what a main Democratic think tank said back in 2013 about, hey, we have to legalize all these illegals because that's how we'll win. So I guess you want to replace white voters, huh? Guess so.
You may have just heard bottom of the hour news there from our national news folks that now we're getting a helping hand from Nestle, one company. They're a huge international conglomerate. They're flying in baby formula to help with mothers who basically can't get it here. How did this happen? Can it happen again? Is there any way you can prevent this from happening? Maybe a government-private sector partnership to talk about that and more. Darren Baxter joins us, Senior Research Fellow, Environmental Policy and Regulation, Agriculture, Trade, the Environment, Hunger, and Food Programs from the Heritage Foundation. Darren, hi. It's Paul at WICC in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. How are you?
Not too bad. Well, give us the big picture of this, Darren. First of all, for a lot of people who may not follow the minutiae of this like you and I do in our jobs, how did this happen?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I think, as you know, families are worried about so many issues right now, food prices and gas prices. And now, unfortunately, some parents are going to have to worry or being worried about baby formula shortages across the country. So, you know, it's a combination of many factors, but there was kind of a growing shortage in late 2021 and then early 2022. And what happened was there was a shutdown of a factory in Michigan, an Abbott Nutrition plant that produces a lot of baby formula. And they had a voluntary recall of baby formula. The plant gets shut down, and that exacerbated the problem. And it is important to kind of recognize that there was already kind of the shelves are starting to empty out even before the plant got shut down. So it's a bit concerning, obviously. And right now, the number is you have empty shelves and that a stock rate for baby formula of over 40%. That's just crazy.
So it sounds like, Darren, this was the perfect storm here, is what you're saying, that all this stuff converged on itself to create the problem we have.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And I think underlying all this is the inflation that's going on, that you have kind of these regulatory obstacles throughout the supply chain that are making it more difficult for businesses across like every industry. Same thing, any problem that other industries are facing, the baby formula industry is facing as well. And that's hindering their ability to kind of get products to the shelves. That's part of it. And that's kind of a starting point. And then you kind of throw in this shutdown that creates a lot of problems. And then, you know, it's kind of important to understand that this is a very unusual market, the baby formula market. More than half of the baby formula in this country is actually purchased through what's called the WIC program, which is a federal governmental assistance program. So it kind of distorts the market in a way because government is so heavily involved in the baby formula market.
Darren, hang on. I want to get deeper into this. What can be done in the future, if anything, to prevent this? Are we talking stockpiling, getting more people in the and companies involved here? More with Darren Baxter straight ahead from the Heritage Foundation about this very strange shortage that, again, I don't recall this ever happening before. It may have. Didn't occur to me, though, that it has. More with Darren Bax coming up. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue to discuss something that, you know, who thought this would happen in modern-day America, but it is, and it's a shortage of baby formula, powdered baby formula, very expensive stuff in good times. And if you folks out there, parents, grandparents, step-parents, whatever, are using it, Darren Baxter is with us. A few more minutes, Senior Research Fellow, Environmental Policy and Regulation, Hunger and Food Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Hey, Darren, is part of the problem here that this one factory, this one factory owned, as you mentioned, by a huge conglomerate here, a huge pharma company, Abbott Labs, is part of the reason, part of the problem here, this one factory is such a big producer of this?
Well, I think it's the fact that it's completely shut down is certainly exacerbating the problem. But there's a lot of issues at play. And I think that right now policymakers need to be focusing on what to do right now to get as much supply onto the shelves as possible. And so, you know, what's interesting is with the WIC program that I was referring to.
Sure, yeah.
When you're a participant in the WIC program, you can only use your benefits to buy formula from one company in that state.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the way the WIC program works. So you don't have a lot of flexibility, and it limits your ability to buy formula. So what needs to happen is policymakers need to make sure that WIC beneficiaries can use their vouchers to purchase formula from any manufacturer. They shouldn't be restricted in any way.
So I didn't know that. Yeah. So apparently, Darren, in the WIC program, it specifies only, for example, from Abbott or from Nestle or from Gerber. They can't just pick whatever one they like?
Not if you're the way it works with the WIC program is that the state awards a contract to one of the baby manufacturers, and basically the idea is that it enables the state to get some rebates on the baby formula, so it lowers the cost for the government.
Oh, it's a contracted rate.
Right. So the problem though is that then therefore it distorts there are other people obviously beyond just WIC participants though buying baby formula, and so it's kind of a very unusual market. And then on top of that, we don't import much baby formula. There's mm-hmm. a lot, let's just be honest, there's a lot of protectionism likely that's involved here in the baby formula market. And there is a significant amount of safe baby formula out there in other countries that we could be having available to American families right now that could increase choice, lower costs, increase supply, that we don't have. And there's just all kinds of tariffs and, again, trade barriers. And what we need to do is address those barriers. And as you mentioned earlier on, that Nestle is flying in some baby formula. Well, you know, that's something that really shouldn't have to kind of, I mean, I'm glad that Nestle's doing it. And the reality is we should be having kind of a flow of safe baby formula from other countries. Mm-hmm. If it's safe, why not?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, it's interesting, Darren. People would hear that and say, well, why can't this happen? And again, you know, it's not like the Europeans are using bad formula. I mean, Nestle and Gerber, these are huge international companies. They've been producing stuff for decades here. So what you're saying is it's contracts, it's federal systems, it's protectionism. Yeah, I would imagine, Darren, again, I haven't used formula for decades. My son is almost 30 years old, but I can imagine, you know, I remember about 30 years ago, I was saying to my wife at the time, geez, this stuff is expensive and, you know, shocking, huh?
It is. And you know, it's concerning. You know, it's concerning when, you know, you deal with the higher food prices and the gas prices. But now we're dealing with, like, baby formula, which is so important for some babies. It's kind of like their sole source of nutrition. So it's a concerning situation. And then we also have all kinds of regulations throughout the system, like labeling regulations for this. And we have regulations that you kind of have to get, like, permission from the government before, like, 90 days before you can market the formula, if you make even little minor changes to the formula. And there's all these dumb regulations that have absolutely little to nothing to do with safety that kind of just undermines the entire system. And we have to waive these regulations, at least right now, so that we can assure that the baby formulas are getting out of the plants and quickly getting to the shelves and to American households.
So finally, Darren, it sounds like we have encountered what we see sometimes where when a system is humming along, it's like a nice V8 engine. When everything is functioning in the engine, it's nice and smooth, and we forget about it, but one or two things break, and then we're broken down on the side of the road here.
Yeah, that's true. And I think one thing to kind of remember is, you know, we are going to see the government, and we already are seeing the government waiving a bunch of regulations, and it kind of begs the question: if we can waive it now, why do we have some of these regulations in the first place? Because these regulations are really not serving much of a purpose, and they just undermine the whole system. And I think we need to get through this shortage. We need to take immediate steps now to do that, and then I think after that we need to thoughtfully look at what has happened, and then develop policies that actually make sense and actually be sure that this doesn't happen again.
All right, Darren, thank you. Darren Baxt, he is the Senior Research Fellow, Environmental Policy, Regulation, Agriculture, Trade, Hunger, and Food Programs at the Heritage Foundation in D.C. Check it out, heritage.org. Hey, Darren, good to speak with you, and we'll check in down the road. Thank you, sir.
Oh, I appreciate it. Take care.
Appreciate it. There you go. Well, who knew? Well, I kind of figured there had to be, you know, these regulatory things that are set up with all the best intentions. I mean, listen, it's baby formula. You can't play around with this. But again, like Darren Bax just said, you know, the WIC program, women, infants, and children, you know, which is, it's for low and moderate income women. I get that. And you see when you go shopping, sometimes there's a regular price for certain things. I see this a lot on like frozen vegetables. You know, your price is this, but with a WIC card, women, infants, and children, you know, it's a lower price, and then the store gets rebated by the feds, and that's okay. But he said there that the WIC program, you know, a lot of the available formula is gobbled up, you know, rhetorically, to say, by parents on the WIC program. So like he said, let's just hope now that there are emergency procedures, because we'll get by this. You know, they said it's going to be about another 6 or 8 weeks. It's going to be tough. And again, I guess people will be going back to, what did somebody call me with the other day? They said milk, Karo syrup. I said, no, give your kids Karo syrup. Come on. Jeez, I'm going to give them something. Give them, you know, Tito's. I'm kidding. It's a joke. Relax. And a lot of folks all around the political world watching some of the primaries last night, looking at who has influence in the Republican Party. Is it back to the establishment GOP? Is it now still in the Trump column? Still a couple of races not decided. Joining us right now is one of our regular contributors. Always great to hear from him. He's a former Time Magazine senior reporter and professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University, Jersey City, New Jersey. Professor Alan Sanders joins us. Professor Paul here again, sir. How are you?
Very good, Paul. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well, Professor. Thanks for joining us. Well, looking at it from afar, what did we learn, Professor, if anything, from some of these big primaries last night, which I guess because of the yes or no of a Trump influence, really were in the national spotlight, Professor, much more than most primaries usually are?
Yes, indeed, because, of course, Trump has made it a point to stay relevant, which most former presidents do not do in major elections. But he's done pretty well. I mean, I would say it's a mixed bag, but overall, Trump did better than not better. His endorsements do make a difference. They are important and valuable, but they are not necessarily decisive. So although I think he walked away with a lot of victories, he didn't walk away with all victories last night for the candidates he endorsed. And so it's a bit of a mixed bag for Trump. That's the way midterms tend to be, because there's no central focus exactly. So certainly one of his big wins was for governor of Pennsylvania. The Republican nominee there will be Doug Mastriano, although many people said that Mr. Mastriano was doing well without the Trump endorsement, but nevertheless, Trump did endorse him. One of the big losses for Trump was, of course, Madison Cawthorn, who's lost his Republican primary yesterday. And another loss for Mr. Trump was for the governorship of Idaho. The incumbent governor there, Brad Little, won over the Trump-endorsed candidate, Janice McGeachin. But on the other hand, the Trump-endorsed candidate in North Carolina for the Senate race, Ted Budd, won. And right now, in Pennsylvania, Dr. Mehmet Oz and David McCormick are in a really tied race, though Dr. Oz seems to be slightly ahead. So it's a mixed bag, but clearly the Trump endorsement is important. It's valuable, but it is not necessarily decisive in all races.
Yeah, I would say, Professor, too, and you know much more about this than I do, but I would say, I would submit to you that with Madison Cawthorn, several, I think even far right-wing Republicans, Professor, had their limit as to what they like to see in photographs of their candidate, particularly those with him wearing some manner of women's lingerie. I saw those pictures, and I said, I think he's done, and he was.
Yes, and he was indeed. That was not a big surprise, but what is surprising is that, of course, Trump decides to stick with him, that was certainly not something that a politician would want to do if you want to exert influence over a broader range of issues. But nonetheless, Trump did support him, and Madison Cawthorn went down to defeat.
Yeah, and to Pennsylvania, boy, Professor, this Dr. Oz thing, in that race, and everybody knows this because of Dr. Oz, you know, a highly qualified physician who became a media star primarily thanks to his appearances with Oprah Winfrey, got into the political arena here like Trump cut his teeth on television. And again, a really interesting battle between Dr. Oz, who again was endorsed by Trump, as you say, you know, David McCormick, a former Bush White House guy, and the third candidate there, this woman who was, you know, from, I don't know what she was. She came out of a far right wing of the Republican Party. And as you say, it's still not decided. But boy, Pennsylvania, Professor, even on the Democratic side, it really is kind of a bellwether, is it not, of how divided the country is?
It sure is. You know, there are two Pennsylvanias. There's sort of an East Coast Pennsylvania, which is anchored by Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And then there's sort of a Midwest Pennsylvania, which is the rest of the state. And it really depends on who comes out to vote and the personal appeal of the various candidates. So Pennsylvania will be certainly something very close to watch. On the Democratic side, I guess we should point out that Josh Shapiro, the current Attorney General of the state, won the Democratic primary, and John Fetterman, the current lieutenant governor, won the Democratic primary for the Senate. He beat Connor Lamb, and Fetterman is a progressive, and so he goes down as a winner for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Connor Lamb was more of a centrist. But, you know, overall on the Democratic side, the fight between centrists and progressives, that also turned out to be mixed when you take a look at the House races. Sort of the hardest fought battles between these two camps came out that, you know, some were won by the progressives, some were won by the centrists, and it came out to be basically a draw on that front as well. So overall, I'd say mixed results, and now we have to stay tuned for the general elections in these various states.
Yeah, and Connor Lamb was interesting, and I know Mr. Fetterman, who won, was a pretty high-profile guy. You know, you hardly ever saw him in a suit, Professor. He was there a lot of times in, you know, shorts and a vest, and a lot of people were siding with him, I guess, in spirit because of the medical scare he had. I thought Connor Lamb would do better because he was held up one or two cycles ago saying, okay, this is what the Democrats have to be to win in the suburbs, but it didn't work for him.
No, it didn't work for him this time. And, you know, Fetterman is a very colorful guy, and you certainly can't miss him when you see him. He's a big guy and quite a formidable presence. I guess that won it for him. And, you know, he espouses liberal policies, and I guess the Democratic primary voters like that. You know, overall, we should always say that, you know, when you're looking at primaries, it's the more committed members that tend to vote. And that tends to usually wind up to be the more extreme candidates that have sort of an edge. They don't necessarily win, but they tend to have an edge. So that's true on the Republican side, and it's also true on the Democratic side, because the committed voters are the ones who come out from primaries. The turnout, you know, is usually low in primaries, and it's really those who are committed and the candidates that appeal to committed voters that wind up to be the winners.
And I think, Professor, finally, we're kind of seeing that with this abortion debate in the high court. You know, we talked about this a few weeks ago. Likely appears they're going to send Roe v. Wade essentially back to the states. And for all the media frenzy that you and I have seen and the stuff I've talked about here on my show and that you've talked about, when you look at the opinion polls and you kind of step away from the primaries, Professor, and look toward November, you know, the projected effect of this might be somewhat, but it doesn't seem to be the massive earth-shattering move that some people think, because a lot of people are against abortion or for abortion. I mean, to a lot of people, the Supreme Court decision, when it likely comes down, is not going to be that much of a surprise, I don't think.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it does cut both ways. The country is quite split on the question of abortion, although a majority of people, voters, want to uphold or to have Roe versus Wade upheld. I think another factor at the moment is that really nothing has happened. All we've got is a draft opinion, mm-hmm. and nothing has happened. The decision will probably come down on the last day of the Supreme Court term. It's known as sort of a get-out-of-town decision.
Yeah.
The justices. They hand down those kinds of decisions on the last day and they get out for their summer vacation. But when that decision comes down, and if indeed it is as draft opinion suggests it will be, then things will happen. That is, that will be the new law of the land, and there are many states that are now poised to outlaw abortion or to certainly restrict it very severely. And when that actually happens and starts to impact real people, I think the issue will resurface. Right now, although it's an important issue, it's kind of academic because nothing has happened yet.
Former Time Magazine senior reporter in D.C. and professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City. Always good to chat with Professor Emeritus Alan Sanders. Professor Sanders, thank you. Take care, and we'll talk down the road.
All right. You take care, too, Paul. Take care.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.